Labour Party. It means the center and left, who were inside the coalition government, they will be the main loser as the political parties. The second loser will be Netanyahu himself, not the right wing as a political platform, but as the struggle against the corruption of Netanyahu. You know, and everybody knows that he is facing three corruption cases in the court. They didn't reach to this budget because they know that the budget must bring a new hard decisions against the most of the citizens and the businesses out of the situation. They connect that with the political crisis in Israel and with the personal crisis of Netanyahu himself toward the corruption cases which he faced this time. For this reason, the budget issue is a symptom of the deep and wide, multiple and complicated crisis which Israel facing. This complicated crisis in Israel since the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948 wasn't in this thing. But there is some of a part of this crisis were something the same. I want to remember, let's remember together, for example. If we are talking about the political crisis, we saw a political crisis before, like what was in Barak on 1999 in Camp David. And it was a big political crisis in that time that will it was in Israel. If we are talking about the economical crisis, we can see two main crises in the history in economics. One, it was in 1985, and the second in 2008.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Classical Lib asks, how many ex-Likudniks have created a new party because Bibi pushed them out? 10 or something like that, right? Noah says, Israel needs a new party, but not with the same old collection of egomaniacs. Michael jokingly says, due to the directives against large gatherings, maybe there should be a directive that no political party can have more than 10 candidates.
Government don't care about the citizens in Israel, and we feel all the corruption in the government taking us down. And Israel is a proud country. We are a proud people who try to save our free and democratic only country in the Middle East. And because of this, the people of Israel is arising against the government.
What took place within the Israeli parliament most recently was that there was a vote to postpone reaching a decision regarding the budget. And while historically and most recently there's been a very strong opposition to Prime Minister Netanyahu from the center and from the left, now there's been a rebellion from the right, and there were members of the ruling Likud party, of actually quit and either joined a new party, or people from the right who were surprised by voting against the proposition. And that is, this is what is enabling a fourth election. So in fact, there is a growing number of people who believe that they can unseat Netanyahu and remove him, and believe that they could serve as better prime ministers. And it is their personal drive that is causing Israel to go for a fourth election. The reason elections are being held on such a frequent basis in Israel is due to the fact that there isn't a clear consensus. Israeli society is deeply fragmented and divided. Various political parties are pushing in various different directions. Due to the fact that Israel is a so-called democracy, because it's democracy for Jews only, but it's a parliamentary democracy, various parties can pull out when they wish and therefore bring down the coalition once a majority is not secured. And that gives increasing power to smaller political parties. The polarization within Israel is getting stronger and deeper, and elections are therefore being held on a more frequent basis as various parties and figures split, and even within these splits, there are various new splits.
To make matters even worse, in a recent speech, Israeli Military Minister Benny Gantz told Israelis on live national TV that he knew Netanyahu is a serial promise breaker, and that Netanyahu lied to Israelis and did not lie to Benny Gantz, even though he formed a coalition with him. So-called Knesset opposition leader Yair Lapid said citizens shared the feeling that they lost control over their lives. The lack of budget for 2020 has contributed to hardships and cutbacks for Israelis, amid unemployment estimated at over 20%. It seems that as the new year looms, so does another election for Israel. The same parties and the same players are on the table. The only thing new would be the money that would have went to a 2020 budget. Now, it remains to be seen if a budget would ever get passed. This, all the while Israelis suffer. Here is the news making the press in Israel. Ynet News. Israel's malls warn they will not close during new coronavirus restrictions. The operators of Israel's malls said that they would not close their doors again if instructed to do so, as part of tighter measures to reduce the rising coronavirus infection rate. Haaretz. Ministries will be forced to cut their budgets in January by about a quarter of planned levels, a total of 10 billion shekels or $3.1 billion, bringing many regime activities to a standstill, an analysis by the finance ministry's accountant general has found. I-24 News. A survey released shows that more than a quarter of a million Israeli households have fallen below the poverty line since the start of the lockdown responses to the pandemic, an increase of almost 50%. According to the welfare charity Leitet, which also provides meal services throughout Israel, approximately 3 in 10 Israelis, 29.3%, live in poverty, which equates to 850,000 households. That figure represents more than a 9% year-on-year increase, 20.1%. The Jerusalem Post. Some 63% of Israelis plan on being vaccinated against the coronavirus, but only 24% of them plan on getting the vaccine immediately, a new poll published by Ynet News has found. One possible explanation for the relatively low number of Israelis willing to be vaccinated immediately is the public's opinion of the safety of the vaccine. Some 23% of Israelis don't know if the vaccine is safe, 17% think it is not safe, and 6% are sure it is not safe, according to the Ynet poll.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Second phase of the revolution.
Of the revolution. Of the revolution.
Leap in production.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said that the aim of economy in the country is to produce wealth and distribute it justly among people. Then he stressed that workers are among the main factors for production of wealth. He said, in the current world and the speedy technological developments, it is a necessity for production groups and workers to continuously learn and use the previous experiences in order to increase economic prosperity through promotion of productivity. Ayatollah Khamenei said that production is the main factor in formation of a national and strong economy, while calling the current Iranian year, which is in its last month, as the year of leap in production. He said, production, besides being vital for the country's economy, has many political, social, and cultural impacts in so that a nation's ability to produce its basic needs will give it self-confidence and will pave the ground for public welfare of society, increase gross domestic production, increase exports, and have cultural impacts of exported goods in other countries. The leader considered the current condition of production inadequate in the country and, emphasizing on the need for further strengthening of production, mentioned some points for acceleration of production in the present circumstances. Valid scientific reports indicate that using scientific capacities in various sectors in a country has led to advancement in defense power, medical fields and control of diseases, engineering fields, biotechnology and related products, peaceful nuclear technology and so on. In view of this, leap in production is important in two aspects. Firstly, leap in production will increase the share of production in the domestic economic move and will push in the course of the advancing goals. Secondly, the demand for science and technology will increase in accordance with economic progress, and the more the national ability to meet this demand, the results will be more palpable. Iran has attained remarkable indices in the field of scientific growth despite harsh sanctions. According to the statistics, Iranian researchers have gained 1.58% of scientific growth in the world. Ayatollah Khamenei, in his statement for the second phase of the Islamic Revolution, puts emphasis on a strong economy and negation of the enemy's influence and infiltration. He says, brilliant youth should consider their main goal in reaching the boundaries of knowledge and technology and pushing forward these boundaries. Dear listeners, the Islamic Republic has proven that if a nation wants to achieve identity, dignity, and security in every field, it requires persistence, self-belief, and self-sacrifice. For over four decades, the United States has used different levers to keep Iran behind in sciences, but the Iranian nation has firmly stood against the U.S. The leader says, one of the necessities of the great Iranian nation's struggle against the arrogance are all-out steadfastness, endeavor, and move for progress of the country in scientific and construction fields, which will pave the ground for prosperity and victory. Elsewhere in his remarks addressing researchers, he said, any nation that falls behind new sciences and technologies will have no faith, but
backwardness, humility, and colonization by powers. Therefore, this speed of scientific move should not decrease or stop in a country. It should rather be kept and strengthened for long years till reaching the scientific pinnacle. Dear friends, all these achievements are the outcome of resistance against pressures. Leap in production is also a targeted move, which will bear fruit in mid-term and long-term. Reduction of scientific, technological, and industrial distance with advanced nations requires innovation in industry and finding new courses for shortcuts. The health system in Iran has proven that it enjoys extraordinary know-how, experience, and staff, which can offer its findings to other nations in various fields, including coronavirus. The Islamic Republic of Iran is the only country in the region that has achieved the knowledge of launching and construction of satellites. In fact, it is considered among five new powers in space technology. Richard Stone of the Science magazine says, "I am familiar with Iran's scientific community, and I should say that despite sanctions that Iran has tolerated, the country's scientific community has shown extraordinary creativity and resilience in overcoming sanctions. It has kept its competitiveness in the global scientific community. Iran is a pioneer in various scientific and technological spheres, particularly nuclear know-how."
European News Bulletin.
Hi there, my name is Amelia Taylor from British Capital. Now we kick things off as there are disappointing news about the aid intervention for the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, as Saeed Porreza reports.
A chilling warning at the end of Monday's virtual UN pledging conference, participated by more than 100 governments and donors. Of the nearly $4 billion sought by the world body, only $1.7 billion was offered. Among the countries cutting aid to the war-ravaged nation, the United Kingdom, a country that's benefited immensely from the sales of weapons to Saudi Arabia, who are using them against the Yemenis.
This is the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. And for any country to slash its aid to Yemen by 50% at this time is a really disgusting act.
By the UN's account, more than 16 billion Yemenis, about half the population, will face hunger this year. Nearly 50,000 are already starving to death in famine-like conditions.
The dying has started because the aid operation is half of what it should have been, and because the war is continuing.
It's a war that's been raging for 6 years now, a Saudi-led military campaign that's received support mainly from the US, the UK, and France. And it all began in 2015, aimed at reinstating this man, Abrabu Mansour Hadi, as president after he lost the capital Sana'a and other strategic territories to the Houthi fighters. What the Saudis thought would be a quick military intervention has turned into a protracted conflict that's killed and injured tens of thousands. In 2019, a UN report said Britain, the US, and France might be complicit in war crimes in Yemen by arming and providing support to the Saudi-led coalition. All three have also provided Yemen with aid.
Britain will stand by Saudi Arabia through thick and thin because of that close economic relationship between the Saudis and the UK. So I don't expect Britain to break that relationship, and I think it's hypocritical, of course, that they are involved in this war on Yemen and at the same time are trying to morally assuage themselves by donating UK aid to that country.
By all accounts, Yemen is on the brink, and with this dramatic reduction in international aid by donor countries such as the United Kingdom, that man-made disaster is bound to take a turn for the worst. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Well, Brett Jonkers, who's the editor-in-chief of Hadad Yemen News Agency, joins us from Belgium. Hi, good to have you on the bulletin. We saw there that UN Chief Antonio Guterres called this disappointing, the way in which the international community has stepped up or failed to do so. Your reaction?
It is definitely a very disappointing development, but unfortunately, I don't think that it could be considered surprising. And even if, let's say, the amount of aid that was given to Yemen, for Yemen was met, the $3.7 billion US dollars that were called for by the United Nations. Even then, of course, this is just barely, you know, scraping by in order to try to save these people. I think Muhammad Ali al-Houthi, one of the main figures within the National Salvation Government of Yemen, which is called, of course, the Houthis, in a lot of media nowadays, he voiced his concern very, very well. He said, you know, the only real aid that Yemen needs is quite simple, the end of the war and the end of the blockade. All of this UN aid and the aid that is given by either the West, by Saudi Arabia, and even by well-meaning countries that are neutral in this conflict, all of this aid is the bare minimum that is necessary in order to somewhat lighten the load that Yemen is carrying, somewhat lighten the misery that Yemen has been carrying, the crimes that have been inflicted on this country ever since 2015. And the fact that even this bare minimum cannot be done by the nations of the so-called civilized world, of the so-called democratic free world of the West, and not by a big organization, of course, a world-renowned organization such as the United Nations, which is created with the express goal of preventing human rights abuses and preventing war worldwide, the fact that this, even this bare minimum, has failed to be achieved is absolutely saddening. But unfortunately, for anyone who has really been following Yemen for years, and especially since this war started in 2015, this is not a surprising act. Yemen has always been silenced. The situation in Yemen has very often not been reported upon by mainstream media and the West especially. They have always tried to hush what was going on in this nation, and even now that it is sort of gaining traction in mainstream consciousness, there is very little being done in terms of deeds to really back off the words that are being spoken. And this is the latest shameful act in a very, very long story of suffering and abuses for Yemen, unfortunately.
Indeed, and very briefly, Brett, it's been a terrible year for Riyadh. We're just hearing this week about the U.S. intelligence and the kingdom's crown prince and the situation with Jamal Khashoggi. And then we're hearing of the millions of Yemenis who are starving due to this Saudi-led war. In the middle here is Saudi Arabia, yet nothing seems to be happening in regards to holding them accountable for any of this.
Yeah, this is definitely what is the biggest case of hypocrisy I think we have seen in a long time. We know for a fact now, and everyone kind of knew that, but even the U.S. has admitted now that Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, is directly responsible for the torture and brutal murder of Jamal Khashoggi. But much more than that, much more important than that, and much more destructive than that, has, of course, been his almost genocidal war against Yemen. And this also is something that has been reported on over and over again, that we know is going on, that we know is happening, 60 million people in direct threat of starvation, and yet, at the end of the day, in the West, especially in the UK, in the US, and in France, the what carries the day in the end, what matters in the end, is the money. And the one country that is willing to give billions, of course, in funding, in oil money, let's say, for to buy this modern equipment, modern war equipment from the West is Saudi Arabia. And so far, this has always been carrying the day. This has always won in the end the argument of money. And as long as the people in the West don't, you know, wake up and start doing something again to hold their governments accountable for this and really force them to come to terms with, you know, the will of the people, then I'm afraid this will continue.
Profit over people, as always. Thank you so very much.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Now we have some worrying news, or it could be worrying news for Labour Party leader Sir Keir Starmer. But before we get into that, Ahmed, social media has been going in on this Yemen story. Just bring it up to date for us, please.
Yeah, I mean, some people are calling up the hypocrisy because, okay, the UK has halved its aid budget to Yemen. So now it's 87 million when it previously pledged 164 million. But what people are calling out the hypocrisy over is that the UK is the second largest arms dealer to Saudi Arabia behind the United States. So we have this bizarre situation where the UK was providing aid in a situation in which it was partly responsible. Now, to give an analogy, that would be like there being a fire and somebody showing up with a small cup of water but with a barrel of gasoline. Now, that is what was happening with the UK in regards to aid, while continuing to sell arms to Saudi Arabia in contradiction to the UK's own ruling, in which it found that the arms sales to Saudi Arabia were illegal because they were used on civilian infrastructure to target schools, hospitals, funerals, and people doing everyday grocery shopping. Now, the UK has reputed that and disputed that claim and said that no, okay, Saudi Arabia does commit war crimes, but these are isolated incidents. Now, Human Rights Watch disagrees with this and says no, there's not isolated incidents, and has submitted a 172-page submission to the UK last year indicating the exact opposite. But, and time and time shows, when it comes to profit, it always trumps morality and in this case, international law. So there has been a fierce reaction online with Chris Williamson, who is the former Labour MP. He says Gulf cuts aid to Yemen yet continues to sell arms to Saudi Arabia. That is responsible for the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. Now, the UN has said that Yemen is the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. Currently there are 20 million people, two-thirds of Yemeni population, who depend on humanitarian assistance. But they wouldn't depend on humanitarian assistance if the war wasn't supported by the UK, France, and the US. And Bernadette says, condemnation for the UK's inexplicable cut to Yemen aid. UK companies profit from the war by selling the bombs. UK military trains the pilots. And then, when the Yemeni people are desperate, UK government cuts the aid. Shameful.
All right. Somebody might be using the term shameful for another situation that's been ongoing inside the Labour Party, but I won't ruin it for you. Bring us the story, Ahmed.
Yes, so Labour demand Labour explain hiring of Israeli spy. So a leading human rights lawyer firm representing a British Palestinian Labour member are demanding answers for the party's hiring of former Israeli spy. And they want to know why a Israeli spy or ex-Israeli spy who was part of the infamous Unit 8200 was hired to monitor the social media usage of Labour members, and are rightfully concerned that this could be used or handed over to Israeli regime forces and agencies, and there could be detrimental consequences for British Palestinian members of the Labour Party and potentially their family back home in Palestine. So as you can imagine, there's been a fierce reaction online. Simon says, shocking, Israeli intelligence officer employed by UK Labour to spy on members' social media accounts. Legitimate criticism of Israeli regime apartheid policies, colonization, ethnic cleansing, racist medical rationing will become impossible. Jack Hughes raises a very important point. He says, why are they calling him a former Israeli spy? Has he had an epiphany? And I think this is an important point, because if you understand what a spy is, the point of a spy is to infiltrate potentially an organization and to work on behalf of another entity. So is he an ex-spy, or is he actually a spy still? Was he working for the Labour Party, or was he still working on behalf of the Israeli regime? These are questions that will rage on, and people will continue to ask and wonder why there hasn't been a response from Sir Keir Starmer or others within the Labour leadership about this action.
All right, that's an excellent question to leave things on, Ahmed Kabbella. Thank you very much. Now, to some other news, because the Pentagon has announced $125 million in military aid for the Ukraine to help in its long-running conflict with Russia. During the White House press conference, Washington stated that the aid would include training, equipment, and advisory efforts, and, quote, to help Ukraine's forces preserve the country's territories. Russia-Ukraine relations deteriorated back in 2014 when the Black Sea Peninsula of Crimea rejoined Russia following a landslide referendum which voted in favor of the unification. The two sides then launched into a bloody conflict in eastern Ukraine, which has so far claimed some 13,000 lives. Russia has previously accused Western nations, such as the U.S., of interfering in its domestic and geopolitical pursuits. Now, opponents and supporters of the embattled Armenian Prime Minister, well, they've held rival rallies in the capital, Yerevan. Thousands of opposition supporters demanded the Prime Minister resign, while others marched to his residence in support. Nikol Pashinyan has faced demands to step down since he signed a peace deal in November that ended 6 weeks of intense fighting with Azerbaijan over the Nagorno-Karabakh enclave. As a result, Azerbaijan reclaimed control over large parts of the embattled region, with some question marks over the army's loyalty.
The army must do its job. The army cannot look back. The army cannot participate in political processes. The army must obey only the people and the political power chosen by the people. Anyone who acts outside this logic, acts against the people, acts against statehood, against the rule of law, and acts against the security of the Armenian Republic.
The uneasy truce between Azerbaijan and Armenia seems to be holding, with pleas from regional powers to maintain the peace. Now, Washington's ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Grenfell, says U.S. President Joe Biden's administration plans on engaging with Iran and repairing its past alliances.
We are looking for opportunities to encourage the Iranians to go back to compliance. And if they make that decision, we are prepared to also rejoin the JCPOA.
It's 1 week after the U.S. and European signatories of the JCPOA met to discuss ways in which they could revive the historic 2018 deal. Tehran, however, has since stated that it would go back to full compliance of the deal once Washington has lifted all of its unilateral sanctions. In some other news now, Saudi Arabia's envoy to the UN says Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is not responsible for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, and the US and Saudi Arabia should just move on. In 2018, the Washington Post columnist was hacked to death inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul whilst his fiancée waited for him outside. A recently declassified U.S. intelligence assessment concludes the Saudi Crown Prince personally approved the operation. Calls for Washington to act on the information are growing louder, but the White House has admitted it does not typically sanction countries it has diplomatic relations with, despite slapping visa restrictions on dozens associated with the murder. Richard Sedan, one of these days you and I are going to discuss some items in social media that will leave us with a pep in our step and joy in our hearts. But today is not that day, sir. Let's begin with some disturbing news from down under.
Yes, and good to be with you again, Amina. This is a shocking headline for our first story. Neo-Nazi leader arrested after assaulting a black security guard at Channel 9. I just want to reference a recent statement by the United Nations Secretary General, who said white supremacy and neo-Nazi movements are a global transnational threat requiring global solutions. With this in mind, the incident which took place in Melbourne, Australia.
An assault captured on film there, Richard.
Exactly, and the black security guard was racially abused at the same time. Thomas Sowell, the self-styled leader of the National Socialists, has now been arrested. What's interesting is actually Thomas Sowell said he, and I quote, fears no investigation, and yet the incident we just saw took place outside Channel 9 precisely because Channel 9 were about to run an investigative report on him and his movement. And I think, you know, and many people agree really and are making this observation, that incidents like these are a stark reminder that anywhere where settler colonialism took place, white supremacy is rearing its head, and increasingly it's being viewed as a very vile, virulent form of extremism. And of course, you know, we're seeing examples of this surface globally, and people are really demanding that the political class take action, and that the media and, of course, politicians really diagnose this kind of white supremacy as it should be, according to how many people see this, Amina.
Now I'd like you to go into the social media there with a few last comments when we come back.
So let's go first to Richard Edwards, who says, given that Victoria Police officers are known for using excessive force, I hope that vile neo-Nazi Thomas Sowell, when caught by police, resists arrest. Held accountable chimes in with, do you know who Thomas Sowell the Australian is? Let me tell you, he is a neo-Nazi trying to organise terror groups. As a conservative living in the USA, you should understand there is no place in society for people like this. Take care.
It's to show this man in his element. He's a literal Nazi, and I think a nasty Nazi wouldn't have been out of order for me to say. Now we move on to another story, Richard, which has some parallels, if you don't mind me saying, but it's on the other side of the ocean. Explain.
This is an interesting one. White nationalists once again are using Christian symbols to spread hate. So there's a number of media outlets picked up on this, Amina. And what's happening is we've seen or are seeing Christian symbolism used increasingly during far-right white nationalist, white supremacist rallies and meetings, whatever you really want to call them. And actually, this was visible none more so than during the January the 6th riots, which took place in Washington, D.C. And this is a very poignant throwback, really, to, of course, the famous symbolism we're all used to seeing, which is, of course, the symbolism of the Ku Klux Klan, most notably in the United States. And I think what many people are saying, this is very dangerous, because when you have extremism ideology with people who really believe they're doing the bidding of God, this makes for a very lethal cocktail, of which we've seen the ramifications of in the past. And I think people are worried now we're essentially going to see some of these ramifications possibly in the present. So again, this is another harsh reminder. We're seeing this kind of ideology, this extremism spreading everywhere. And actually, January the 6th was a very pertinent example of that, Amina.
So how are we able to make a clear distinction as to an extreme minority fringe who are misusing and misappropriating a sacred symbol here, when, dare I say it, other religions don't escape as freely?
That's a very important point and question indeed, Amina. And I think one thing we should say here, of course, is that there are millions of Christians, millions of people of all faiths all around the world that are actually fighting against racism in all of its forms. But there's no getting away from this. This kind of symbolism has a massive presence in the US, certainly amongst, for example, the Proud Boys and also the Oath Keepers, the Three Percenters, and many other groups. And so I think, you know, we've seen this, we're probably going to see more of it. And I think many people would agree, and many people are certainly saying, it makes for the worst kind of apologism, really, regarding this kind of extremism, which we're seeing surface time and time again, Amina.
All right, let's rattle through some of that reaction.
Let's go to Jay Garner first, who says, evangelicals are the American version of the Taliban. I would not want to be in any heaven that would have them. They twist and shape God to be who they want him to be. Andy Hawkins says, white nationalists are once again using Christian symbols to spread hate. Makes complete sense. Why the surprise? We have a reaction from Andrew Netta Williams, who says the white people in power in America don't want to admit it exists. That's why they haven't been given the same attention, because they are white. And we have a reaction from Mad Dogs, who says the only hate being spread is the liberal media and left extremist Democratic Party. I don't know any conservative that spreads hate, but I do know many liberals who do. Just a reminder, Amina, there's a plethora of reactions and different views online talking about this story.
All right. All right, we leave it there, Richard Sedan, and we leave you here for the moment. In any case, stay safe.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a televised speech delivered on January 8, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
The vaccine produced in Iran is a source of pride and dignity. The last issue is about the coronavirus. I wish to speak about it again. First of all, the vaccine produced is a source of pride. This should not be denied. The same is true of the present time. They have produced a vaccine and it has been tested on humans, and by Allah's favor, they will produce an even better and more complete vaccine. In other words, it will be perfected on a daily basis. It has been successful until today, and it will continue to be successful from now on too, God willing. This is the first point, which is a source of pride. I thank all those who are involved in this, including the Ministry of Health and others who were involved in the production of the vaccine.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
The second point about Corona is that importing American and English vaccines into the country is forbidden. I have said this to officials and I am saying it publicly now. If the Americans had managed to produce a vaccine, this Corona disaster would not have occurred in their own country. A few days ago, they registered 4,000 deaths in the course of 24 hours. If they know how to produce a vaccine, and if the Pfizer company can produce a vaccine, Why would they give it to us? Well, they can use it for themselves so that they will not have so many deaths and so many victims. The same is true of England. Therefore, they are not trustworthy. I do not really trust them. I do not know. Perhaps they sometimes want to test their vaccines on other nations to see if it works out or not. Therefore, we should not obtain a vaccine from the US and England. Of course, I do not trust the French either. The reason is that they have a history of giving us contaminated blood products. HIV, tainted blood supplies from France given to Iran in 1980s. However, if our officials decide to obtain a vaccine from other places, from safe places, it will be all right.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to
the world with reporters.
The International Atomic Energy Agency's 35-nation Board of Governors convenes a virtual meeting with reports that Britain, France, and Germany are circulating a draft resolution to criticize Iran for restricting agency access. IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi reached a temporary bilateral understanding with Iran over a week ago, allowing the agency to continue verification work in the country for up to 90 days. Grossi said the understanding was meant to provide a window of opportunity for political talks to get underway amid attempts to revive the nuclear deal between Iran and world powers, known formally as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. The possibility of a board resolution, however, is further complicating the situation. Grossi appealed for constructive discussions that would preserve the work of the agency.
The inspection work of the IAEA must be preserved. The inspection work of the IAEA should not be put in the middle of a negotiating table as a bargaining chip.
Iran has warned of countermeasures if the board passes the resolution and says it's cooperating with the agency over questions about the presence of uranium particles at two undeclared sites. Grossi reiterated the IAEA would remain impartial, avoid judging intentions or issuing condemnations.
The work and the trust must always exist. And when we have doubts, we ask questions. We are not condemning anybody.
It's still unclear if the board will adopt the Western-backed resolution, but Russia has already made it clear it will oppose it. In a note to other board members, Russia warned the adoption of the resolution would hugely complicate efforts to revive the nuclear deal and undermine normal cooperation between Iran and the agency. Homolezgi, Vienna.
Among other things, the past year felt like a long one, featuring several announcements from British Chancellor Rishi Sunak, from massive spending to protect jobs.
Today, we've announced £4.6 billion of additional help.
To the so-called Eat Out to Help Out scheme, and to what's known as the stamp duty holiday to help homebuyers. Since he was unexpectedly made chancellor in February last year, Mr. Sunak has only made one formal fiscal statement. But on the 3rd of March, the young chancellor will unveil his very difficult second budget, originally expected November last year, but postponed because of the uncertainty created by the raging pandemic and the possibility of a no-deal Brexit. But has that fog of uncertainty cleared now that they have a Brexit deal?
The biggest trade deal yet?
And the vaccination program is at full blast. Not exactly. The pandemic is still very much here, meaning serious restrictions will remain in place till at least midsummer. So given that lingering uncertainty, what does the UK public anticipate from Mr. Sunak's announcement? One expectation is an extension to the £20 a week increase in the government handout to the poor, benefiting some 6 million families due to end in March.
Yeah, a lot of people I know who actually sort of, that is all they're earning at the moment, is literally their less than £400 a month. Yeah, it's definitely vital for them.
People are on it for a reason, you know. I know a nurse who's working 5 days a week and still has to be on universal credit.
There will probably also be an extension of the furlough scheme due to end in April. The UK's jobless rate rose to over 5% in the 3 months to December, leaving unemployment at 1.7 million.
It's hard to think that you're going to be able to find a lot of jobs for people right now, but they're coming back at some point, hopefully. But in the meantime, I mean, people have to get by somehow. People need money to buy food. People need money to just survive.
There are lots of people all over the country who don't have any income or have significantly reduced income because of the pandemic and the crisis.
Also expected, an extension of the various tax breaks help to educate children whose schooling has been so badly disrupted, or for the health service to cope with its long backlog of non-COVID waiting lists. And then there's the question of tax rises. The Chancellor has dropped many hints that tax rises are inevitable. Hikes in corporation tax, capital gains tax, carbon pollution taxes, and a new online sales levy are all under consideration.
Economists are unanimously warning the Chancellor to hold off imposing any new tax hikes, saying they will merely damage the economy. But will he heed that advice? And how will it impact the lives of millions of people around the country if he chooses to ignore it? Saeed Puriza, London.
Prisoners' rights activists and families of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prisons held a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. They protested to drum up support for thousands of Palestinian prisoners and demanded an end to Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian political prisoners. Some 5,000 Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers.
Israel has demonstrated zero accountability and acts with impunity because it enjoys the full support of the United States. Israel considers itself as an entity that is above international law. Israel must be held accountable for its crimes against the Palestinian people, especially against Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners see no end in sight to their suffering, as around 400 of them are being held without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention, where incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely.
Palestinian prisoners are suffering because of medical negligence as well as administrative detention in Israeli prisons, and their situation became much worse during the coronavirus pandemic. We call on international organizations to exert real pressure on Israel in order to stop its illegal and inhumane practices against Palestinian prisoners.
Many Palestinian prisoners also suffer from chronic illnesses and are denied proper medical treatment by Israel's prison service, who runs Israeli prisons. Dozens of prisoners suffer from cancer and other life-threatening diseases.
The suffering of Palestinian inmates in Israeli prisons is unprecedented. They're being oppressed on a daily basis, and the Israeli regime is systematically killing the prisoners by denying them proper medical care. We're here today to let the whole world know that we're standing with the prisoners.
Palestinian inmates are more vulnerable now with the absence of vital preventive measures during the coronavirus pandemic.
Experts say that the protection Israel enjoys from some countries like the United States gives it the green light to continue to violate the rights of Palestinian prisoners. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
2021's Defense Ministry has delivered 9 military and transportation planes, 10 choppers, and tens of engines repaired at Iran Aviation Industries Organization to the Iranian Armed Forces. Iranian specialists have overhauled 9 jet fighters, including F-4, F-14, F-27, and Mirage types, as well as transportation types of planes, including C-130, 707, and 747. The types of the 10 overhauled helicopters range from 204 and 205 to 212 and 214, which have applications in combat and rescue operations. The engines overhauled include turbojet, turbofan, and turboshaft types.
The enemy was in vain efforts to defeat Iran through sanctions and restrictions on buying military equipment. But the country conquered the enemy by reliance on indigenous capability, building military equipment, and optimizing defense equipment. Iran's successful strategy has defeated the enemy's maximum pressure policy.
Iran has utilized capacities of domestic knowledge-based companies in overhauling and repairing the helicopters and planes.
The Air Force of the Islamic Republic of Iran is a dynamic, innovative, and self-sufficient sector, which is completely reliable for operational purposes. The delivery of several planes and helicopters to the force indicates the creativity of our experts with which we have optimized and upgraded our equipment. We will defend our country's borders under all conditions in the best way.
In recent years, Iran has made great strides in the defense sector and become self-sufficient in producing essential military hardware and defense systems. Iran has repeatedly made it clear that its military might is merely defensive and that it poses no threat to other countries.
Iran says at a time of sanctions, overhauling light, semi-heavy, and heavy military equipment is the most cost-effective and safest way to boost the country's defensive capabilities. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
One year has passed from a meeting in the Qatari capital, Doha, where the US and Taliban representatives inked a deal to put an end to decades-long misery of the Afghan nation by reaching an agreement to bring peace to the war-ravaged country.
The release of 5,000 Taliban inmates, the withdrawal of foreign troops, and the Taliban's approval of a ceasefire were the main parts of the US-Taliban deal. The prisoners were released, but the other two commitments have not been fulfilled yet.
Soon after the US-Taliban deal was signed, the first round of intra-Afghan talks kicked off in Doha. This once again ruined the dreams of Afghans as it failed to bring peace. Now, Afghan officials not only warn the Taliban to either approve a lasting peace or get ready to be killed by Afghan armed troops, but blame the international community for depriving Afghans of their fundamental right, that is peace.
The international community has deprived a great nation, which has a great history and bright civilization, of one of their fundamental rights, that is peace. This is unacceptable. We want a lasting peace that should be achieved via our armed troops' power and will of the nation.
The Afghan peace process is facing some key obstacles, including foreign interference. But the bitter fact is that the main victims of war are innocent civilians. Based on an annual report by Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission on humanitarian conditions for Afghan children, nearly 6,000 civilians, including more than 2,000 children, were killed in 2020 due to war and violence in Afghanistan.
The total number of civilian casualties recorded by Independent Human Rights Commission over the last year is 5,800. 2,019 of them are children. That is why we want all warring sides to pay respect to civilian lives.
Let's not forget that the new U.S. administration has announced Washington is going to review the U.S.-Taliban deal. The declaration was welcomed by the Afghan government, but the Taliban urgently reacted and blamed the U.S. for seeking a pretext to stay in Afghanistan further. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela might be about to break relations with the Kingdom of Spain after Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro announced he would review relations of all kinds with the European country due to what he calls their improper and disrespectful actions against Venezuela. Experts say that Spain, among members of the European Union, is regarded as the most important influence in the European policy toward the nations of Latin America. In the light of rising political tensions between Caracas and Madrid, Maduro denounced